Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:30 p.m. Friday, February 6, 2026. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Doug Bridges from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Tilton, Senator Stevens, Senator Tobin, my Vice Chair, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. We are all here. The first and only item on our agenda today is Senate Bill 190, Uniform Act Guardianship Conservatorship, sponsored by Senator Keel. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee, but the first hearing of the bill this year. Here to present the bill is Senator Keel and his staff. Laura Houck, available for questions. Noah Klein from the Alaska Court System. Senator Keel and Ms. Houck, if you would please come forward, put yourselves on the record. You may begin your presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Jesse Keel, and I have the privilege of representing Senate District B.
My name is Aurora Houck, and I have the privilege of representing Senator Keel.
The privilege is mine, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for taking time with just a simple little bill this afternoon. Senate Bill 190 does adopt and update Alaska's laws for guardianship and conservatorship based on the most recent uniform law by the National Uniform Law Commission. Guardianships and conservatorships are legal protective arrangements. They are designed to protect Alaskans who are not able to meet some of their basic needs for their own health, their own safety, or their own self-care. It's a serious matter, these arrangements. They are protective. That's what they're for. They are also a restriction of a person's liberty. And so it's incumbent on us as legislators to make sure that we have a good framework in place for balancing that carefully. In a guardianship or a conservatorship, someone else, whether a family member, a private guardian, or a public guardian, or conservator, takes on some of those responsibilities for a person's financial or physical well-being. And so it's really important that our laws maintain that individual's human dignity and rights in the least restrictive way possible to serve their best interests. Alaska's current laws do an okay job with that. Today, Alaska courts can grant full or limited guardianship or conservatorship, and the law allows for certain less restrictive options, but it is not well built for nuance. And the more recent versions of this uniform law from the Uniform Law Commission, I think, do a better and will allow Alaska courts the opportunity to do a better job. I will oversimplify the status quo. It is often described as sort of a three-position switch. You're on your own, you have a conservator who takes care of your money, or you have a guardian who makes all your decisions for you from a legal standpoint. Again, that's an oversimplification. The goal is to allow courts a much more nuanced approach. Alaska's laws are rooted in a uniform law version from the 1980s. A lot has changed since then, and we understand more about the people who are subject to some of these protective arrangements. So this version came from an interdisciplinary group of folks who are involved with guardianship and conservatorship, who advocate for people protected by those arrangements. It's called the Wings Group. We have someone from who's able to talk a little bit more about them. But they have worked very hard to review this model law and to tailor it for Alaska. Beth Russo, who is with AARP's National Governmental Affairs Section, will be able to talk in some more detail about that just a little later on this afternoon. So what does Senate Bill 190 do? It increases transparency and it increases notice, so nobody gets caught by surprise. It recognizes that people who need this kind of help really are on a spectrum. It shifts the focus of what happens in court from testing whether a person is incapacitated to looking at their specific needs and their specific abilities. It clarifies the roles of everyone involved in the process. It improves the annual reporting. It limits, and I think this is important to me, it limits the length of emergency guardianships, which today can be unlimited. Under the bill, an emergency guardianship can be granted for 60 days. That can be renewed once. It also updates, Mr. Chairman, some archaic terminology. Frankly, some of the terms in our laws for people who could use some protection are better suited to a Charles Dickens novel than the respectful language that we try and use for Alaskans today. So the bill is fairly narrowly focused on the court process for granting these kinds of protective arrangements. We don't get into child in need of aid laws. We don't get into how we license guardians. Those laws we leave alone in this bill. I am certainly committed to working with all of you on the committee and interested Alaskans to fine-tune the bill in whatever ways we think it needs so that we can accomplish the goal of improving our system and improving the lives of Alaskans who need these protections. With your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn to my staff, Aurora Hawk, to orient the committee a little more specifically to the bill.
Sounds good. Thank you. Especially because I see no questions yet.
For the record, Aurora Hawk. Okay, so Section 1 amends... So you have before you a 17-page sectional analysis, and I wanted to note that in the sectional analysis, the main page that you see, you'll also see that it starts on Section 66. We'll get back to 1 through 65 at the end of the sectional. Puts the four different types of protective arrangements that are in this legislation side by side and walks you through the process for granting them. And so you will see that some sections are substantially similar and some are slightly different. For instance, the very first one is the basis for appointment, and this is an important section because it shifts the focus of the determination from determining that somebody is incapacitated to looking at their actual needs and abilities and what would be best suited for them. In addition, it establishes the court as the sole grantor of guardianships for minors. And then the legislation goes through who may petition the court for a guardianship or conservatorship or another protective arrangement, who must be noticed, and who needs official service and who can be noticed in other means. Goes through the role of the court visitor in determining, in investigating, and the needs of the individual, and notes when an attorney should be appointed upon the individual's request or if it's recommended by the court visitor. If an adult requests it, also a professional evaluation by a doctor is required. And then it lists who should be at the hearing unless accepted by the court, who can be at the hearing, has the right to be at the hearing, and then any other individuals who are interested may petition to participate. There is a confidentiality of records section. And where more than one guardian or conservator is nominated by any of the parties, there's an order of prioritization to determine who should be considered to be the guardian or conservator first. And then after the court has gone through this process, they order the appointment or they arrange for other protective arrangements. And that must also be noticed. We also have a section in each for emergency appointments, except for under the other protective arrangements, which are not appointing a guardian or conservator, so that section is not in there. The emergency appointments, as Senator Keel said, are limited to 60 days and may only be renewed once. There's also noticing requirements for that and an additional hearing if the emergency appointment is made without notice and without a hearing. Then it lists the powers of a guardian of a minor, or the powers of a guardian of an adult, and the powers of a conservator. Outlines what must be in the plan that must be filed for the care of the individual. And the report that must be made annually also has a list of things that must be included in that report, and that the report must be noticed to the individual as well. Finally, a guardian or a conservator can be removed for failing to do their diligence or to fulfill their duties, and that can be done by petition or on the court order. There are a process for terminating a guardianship as well. For instance, once a minor becomes an adult or becomes emancipated, they no longer need a guardian. And then starting on page 9 of the sectional, you've got the specific statutes that apply to that particular category of protective arrangement. For instance, a standby guardian for a minor, somebody nominated by the parent once something happens and there is need of a standby guardian, there's a process for appointing that person. The conservatorship obviously has a lot more special actions because they're dealing with financial transactions. And so there's a lot of guidance on that. And then if we move on to Article 5, that is starting on the sectional on page 12, that is your forms section. Article 6 is miscellaneous provisions that have to do with how this interacts with other states and federal. And then you have general provisions that determine things like how to transfer proceedings from one jurisdiction to another, or determine which venue has priority if a case is in more than one place. And then finally, the rest of the bill starts on page 17, the last page of the sectional, and it lists all of the other sections that update terminology or change references to the statute. And there's a lot of them because this concept arises in statute a lot. Also, you have Section 101, which is your big repealer section that repeals the current law that is being replaced by this chapter, along with some definitions that are superseded by this. You have Sections 102 and 103 that require court rule change, indirect court rule change, and so the bill will require a 2/3 vote of each house in Section 108. In addition, you have sections dealing with applicability and transition language. So anything that starts after the effective date of this law moves forward, and if anything that is already in place remains in place under the previous law until something changes. And I also would like to correct for the record a statement that I made in the last hearing
Last year.
Yes. I've done a little bit more research and I have more nuance to the 19 states that have passed the uniform law is actually any of the uniform laws. And also parts of this current law, because certain states were looking for better sections on conservatorship. And so they just pulled the conservatorship. So, and I have a map that I just finished that I will share with the committee.
So just for clarity, that's 19 states that have adopted some or all of the guardianship law, as opposed to 19 states that have adopted some uniform law, of which there may be hundreds.
Yeah. Correct. Okay. Correct. Yeah. And not all of them have adopted this version of the uniform law.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions that are unrelated, so I'm going to start with my first. And I forgive me, as I don't know how these two sections interact, so I'm hopeful you might be able to unpack. But I'm particularly looking at page 38. I know it's in other sections of the bill around emergency guardian for minors. And I'm curious how this might work with the OCS system, or if a child, if some dynamic of some child who's in crisis might need someone to step in to help make determinations or decisions while something else is going about. And I'm unclear of how those kind of two systems interact with one another.
I stand to be corrected, but my understanding is that a child in need of aid proceeding takes precedence.
And so, Ms. Chairman, in answer to Senator Tobin, just a little further, we're really going to see child in need of aid cases when there is a physically unsafe situation, right? A parent who is unable, or a parent who is alleged to be doing harm to the child. These emergency guardianships arise in a situation where we don't have the state needing to immediately take a child out of a home as a ward. The old term is ward of the state. they should cover different situations.
There is,
yes.
Oh, there is also
not yet.
In section 1329.425 on page 128 to 129 that deals with the venue when there is already a child in need of aid proceeding happening.
Which pages are those?
128 through 129. And it's section 425.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that's helpful. And we'll follow up with you a little bit more as I'm just curious. And the dynamic I think of is when you might have divorce proceedings or some sort of estate dynamic where the child might need someone to speak for them in a legal construct, or they might need additional support that is outside of the purview of maybe their guardians or potentially their parents. My second question to you is, starting on page 50, and there's another section on page 77 around the priority of conservator and guardian. And I'm curious why spouse is listed so late. And I think particularly in terms of my father, if there was a need for him to have an emergency guardian or conservator and I am unable, he would be the next most knowledgeable or competent person to step in, and I'm unclear of why the spouse is listed so far below the other folks.
Through the chair, Aurora Hawk, I believe that might be a question for either the Uniform Law Commission or our invited testifier, and so we can follow up with that.
And in terms of invited testifier, do you mean Beth Russo?
Correct.
Why don't we go to Beth Russo right now to see if she can answer that question, because she's here with us. Not in the room, but Ms. Russo, did you hear the question from Senator Tobin?
Yes, Chair Clayman. Thank you. Senator Tobin, my understanding, and I would defer if there is going to be testimony further on from the Uniform Law Commission, I'll certainly defer to them because I was not part of this drafting committee. But the idea behind the priority, I just had the priorities in front of me, and okay, excuse me, is that the priority is either somebody who's already been appointed as a guardian or conservator for the individual, and then it's somebody who's been nominated by the individual under a power of attorney. So hopefully if somebody has executed a power of attorney, they probably nominated their spouse as the person to be their guardian or conservator. Or an agent, and then it's the spouse. So the idea is that really trying to put emphasis on looking at the powers of attorney that have already been executed or the guardianships that are already in place. And then once the courts made the determination that nothing like that exists, then it is the spouse.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. That is very helpful to know. And I think it's, again, a good reminder for the public. Hopefully everyone who is listening is thinking about creating their own durable health proxies, their own living wills, and also their last will and testament, because these are very critical documents to have, even when you're as young as I.
All right. That wasn't a question. And I will note, Ms. Russo, that the Uniform Law Commission is not on the line today. You're our best expert today. All right. Other questions from the committee? I have a follow-up question with regard to child in need of aid proceedings versus guardianship proceedings. Broad terms, a child in need of aid proceeding is somebody that the state is essentially taking custody of the child, whether for a long term or a short term. The state is intervening and becoming in some framework sort of the parent for a period, whereas a guardianship proceeding is more often arises outside of a place in which they're finding the child can't be taken care of, and there's kind of an emergency situation, whereas the guardianship is more planned out. Senator Keel or Ms. Hawk, is that consistent with your understanding, or am I missing the boat on that?
Mr. Chairman, I think that is that's very well put. And I would only add an additional nuance that our child in need of aid laws are geared toward first reunifying the family, making the home a safe place. And so when we look to the longer term solutions of a guardianship, that's usually, as I say, in that different context, it should be in a non-emergent situation most of the time.
Okay. All right. I do not see any other questions from the committee. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question about the fiscal note. Will we have folks here from the court system, and I see from statewide services, to answer questions related to these particular documents?
We certainly have somebody from the court system here to answer questions about the court system's fiscal note. Mr. Klein. And I don't think we have anybody online. The only person here today is Mr. Klein. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And hello, Mr. Klein. It's good to see you. I'm looking at the court system's fiscal note, and I'm curious, as it indicated that you would need a part-time attorney, and I'm assuming this particular attorney that you would be seeking to hire would need to be well-versed in guardianships and conservatorships, and just curious about the timeline on hiring that person. I know that we here in the state of Alaska are struggling a bit with finding talented and competent folks to do some of the critical work that we need. And so just interested is if this bill went into effect tomorrow, what do you think the timeline and horizon would be?
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, thank you for the question. We would imagine
make sure you tell us who you are, even though I told us who you are.
Excuse me, rookie mistake. For the record, my name is Noah Klein. I'm associate counsel for the Alaska court system. Thank you, Senator Tobin, for the question. We would imagine 3 months maximum to hire an attorney. One thing we could potentially do in a situation where we needed help with rules or we needed help with forms, we have a rules attorney employed by the court system. We also have a forms attorney employed by the court system. They're both incredibly busy positions, but to the extent any expertise was necessary, we could potentially put the more senior attorneys we already have employed doing the work on this bill and hire someone to help them with their day-to-day duties as assigned.
And just on that, would this be somebody that you'd be hiring a private attorney to be a contractor with the court system, or would you be hiring somebody as a court employee for a period?
To the chair, again, this is Noah Klein with the court system. We would be hiring an employee. So this, what our fiscal note shows, is for a benefited position for 6 months.
Other questions? All right. Then before we go, we do have Ms. Russo, I believe, is here to provide invited testimony. Yes, and so, Ms. Russo, would you like to proceed with your testimony?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Klayman, and committee members, for this opportunity to provide testimony on SB 190, the Uniform Guardianship, Conservatorship, and Other Protective Arrangements Act. My name is Beth Russo, and I am a government affairs director for AARP and its national office. I advise AARP state offices across the country on issues related to elder justice, including guardianships and conservatorships. As you may know, I spent much of my career in Alaska and served as the head of the public guardians for a number of years, and then as the deputy director of the Office of Public Advocacy. When I lived in Alaska, I was active with the WINGS group. That's the Working Interdisciplinary Network of Guardianship Stakeholders. That group formed as the result of a grant from the Administration on Community Living, and it is a group that convened through the court system. It was a grant that went through the court system and involved various community stakeholders in guardianship cases, including representatives from AARP, the hospitals, Office of Public Advocacy, the Attorney General's Office. I believe the Social Security Office was an invited member. So it was really a private professional guardians were also on the WINGS committee. And so it really is quite the stakeholder working group. One of the subcommittees that WINGS had was the statutory subcommittee. And that was under the leadership of Teresa Holt, AARP's state director. That committee compared Alaska's current guardianship laws with the Uniform Act, which I'm going to refer to as UCOPA for short. And it made recommendations regarding the adoption of UCOPA to the larger group. Those recommendations were adopted by the larger group and found their champion with Senator Keel. Before I go into discussing some more of the differences between the current law and what is proposed in SB 190, I just wanted to take a few moments to talk about guardianships in general. And for purposes of my testimony today, I'm going to be referring to guardianships in the for both guardianships and conservatorships. Guardianships are when talked about individually, guardianships deal with decisions about the person, such as medical decisions, housing, vocational decisions, and conservatorships deal with decisions about money and legal matters. Full guardianships encompass both.
All participants are unmuted.
Our current guardianship system in this country has its roots in feudalism. I think that's sort of helpful to understand how everybody is at play here. It's the idea that the lord of the manor is taking care of his subjects. So when a court appoints a guardian for a person, it's exercising the state's parens patriae authority. the court is appointing someone to make decisions on its behalf for a person who can't make their own decisions. And this appointment may be for some specific kinds of decisions or for all decisions. A full guardian is someone who can make decisions for a person about what kind of medical care to receive, where they can live, what educational or vocational opportunities should be explored. They can make decisions about how and where the person's money is spent. So guardianships are put in place to protect individuals, but they are also designed to maximize a person's independence, to help them operate in the world as if they did not have the limitations that caused them to lack the ability to make decisions. So appointing a guardian is one of the most invasive actions the state can take in the lives of its citizens. And so we really want to make sure that individuals receive full due process of the law, both before and during the lifetime of their case. Alaska's current guardianship laws, as referred to earlier, are based on an earlier version of the Uniform Probate Code, but they can do better. They can be better. That's where UCOPA comes in. It basically takes what is already in Alaska statute and expands it to better protect the rights of vulnerable individuals who are subject to these types of proceedings. Full guardianship should always be the last resort. Courts should try and find less restrictive alternatives. However, that doesn't always happen. So UCOPA's language makes it clear that full guardianship should be the last resort by prohibiting a court from ordering one if a limited guardianship, protective arrangement, or other less restrictive alternative would meet the needs of a person. It requires petitioners to explain why limited guardianships or protective arrangements are not sufficient, and it adds an entirely new section to Alaska's guardianship statutes, which is the other protective arrangements portion of this law. I'll just go through and highlight a couple of the differences and improvements that are made by this bill. In Article 1 of UCOPA, that is the minor guardianship section. Currently, there's very little reporting done in cases involving minors by the guardians. Guardians and conservators of minors have the same fiduciary responsibilities as guardians and conservators of adults. The court has the same duty to protect the interests of minors as it does for vulnerable adults. And UCOPA makes that duty clear by highlighting reporting and notice requirements in this section. It adds court visitors to certain minor guardianship cases and provides counsel to children ages 12 and older if their guardian, if they or their guardian ad litem request. UCOPA does away with testamentary guardianships that don't require court approval. Under UCOPA, the court is expected to appoint the person nominated by a parent, unless for some reason that's not in the child's best interest, but UCOPA makes it clear that the court should be involved with all guardianship appointments. In Article 2, the most...
Ms. Russo, you get to Article 2, just one question. Does the, in contrast to the current law, does the Uniform Act, if adopted, does that actually give the court a broader range of options about the level of guardianship? I know there's full guardianship, which, as you say, is one of the more invasive, but does the Uniform Act that we're considering actually give the court a more diversity of options in terms of how much of a guardianship to order compared to the present law?
Yes, I think it does. It really it really comes under the other Protective Arrangements Act, but even within the guardianship section, the UCOPA makes it clear that limited guardians, and it can be limited for specific purposes, limited for specific time frames. It's the emphasis within this bill really is on limiting the guardianship, so it's not just appointing a full guardian for the next 50 or 60 years of a person's life.
Thank you.
And so just going on into that Article 2 section on guardianships, there are increased due process protections for respondents in the form of more robust requirements for petitions, notices, and reports. And similarly to the minor guardianship statute, there's no longer an ability under UCOPA to have a testamentary guardianship for an adult. Another major change is the nomenclature surrounding emergency appointments. Currently in Alaska law, they're referred to as temporary guardianships. And so it would be a change from temporary to emergency, making it clear that these types of appointments are truly for exceptional circumstance and of a limited duration, as current law does not actually have any kind of statutory limit on the length of temporary appointments. UCOPA also greatly expands the requirements that are listed under a guardianship plan. And the idea of a guardianship plan is that's the guardian telling the court what the guardian's plan is to help the individual, to protect them, and also to help them maximize their independence. And so some of this information used to be in the implementation report, but UCOPA shifts it to the plan with the idea that a guardianship plan is being submitted to the court and can be refined over time so that as a person's needs change over the course of their life and over the course of the guardianship, the plan will also change. The next section is the conservatorship statute. Many of the changes discussed above before with regards to guardianships are mirrored in the section on conservatorships. The bill greatly expands notice provisions and iterates that the basis for conservatorship is a functional one and not merely because somebody has a particular diagnosis or status. And then Article 4 is the other protective arrangements section. This is what I think personally is the most innovative part of UCOPA, because what it does is it allows individuals to petition the court for a protective arrangement that's not a guardianship or a conservatorship. And it also allows the courts to convert petitions for guardianships or conservatorships into petitions for other protective arrangements. It specifically allows the courts to fashion orders that are somewhere between limited guardianships and conservatorships and full guardianships and single transactions. It allows judges and parties to be creative, basically, in coming up with a personalized solution that can help a vulnerable adult best maximize their independence while keeping them safe. Article 4 also contains the general provisions and updates that affect all protective proceedings. One of the problems individuals sometimes have with these cases, if it's a layperson trying to be involved with these cases, is knowing where to find information related to each type of proceeding.
Ms. Russo, we're going to take a brief at ease because we're having some audio issues. Brief at ease. Okay. Back on record. Please proceed.
Thank you. Article 4 contains general provisions. So it's one of the issues has been when lay people are trying to work their way through the statutes, is that they don't always know where to find information regarding each type of protective proceeding. Sometimes an issue is addressed in the general section. Other times it's addressed in the guardianship section. Sometimes it can be listed in both guardianships and conservatorships. So UCOPA expands the general section so that when it's possible to address commonalities in one place, it does. For example, venue is currently addressed in AS 1326-137, 216, and 411. SB 190 addresses venue for all proceedings by a single statute in general in the general section 1329-425. Additionally, as Senator Keel mentioned, several terms have been updated to reflect how society has grown to recognize the dignity of all people. UCOPA eliminates the term incapacitated person and instead applies a functional test to determine if somebody requires the appointment of a guardian. The elements of the functional test are largely similar to what's currently in the statutory definition of incapacity. But by eliminating that term, UCOPA puts the focus on a person's actual abilities and needs versus a particular status. These kinds of changes extend to replacing the term ward with adult or minor subject to guardianship. This also clarifies the roles of GALs and attorneys for individuals who have trouble communicating. Alaska's current statutes can blur the line sometimes between attorneys who advocate for a person's expressed interest and GALs whose job it is to advocate for a person's best interest. UCOPA anticipates that guardian ad litem appointments should be used sparingly, and in fact, given Alaska's robust use of court visitors, they should rarely be required. A new section worthy of note is section 1329-480, which requires the disclosure of certain criminal history and bankruptcy by potential guardians and conservators. If adopted, this law would not necessarily preclude individuals with certain backgrounds from serving as a guardian or conservator, but what it does is it helps ensure that a court is making a fully informed choice when appointing someone to a position of trust. And although this is not mentioned specifically in Article 4, but rather in the respective articles for each type of case, under UCOPA, hearings in these cases are presumed to be open, although they can be closed on the respondent's request and for good cause. The practice in Alaska has been that hearings are assumed to be closed unless the respondent requests for them to be open. However, court records beyond notices of the proceedings and dispositional orders will still be confidential.
One more question. Mm-hmm. You spoke about guardians ad litem, and I know the public advocate has a number of guardian ad litems on staff. Are guardian ad litems, if appointed by the court, being appointed in a child and evade case, are they being appointed under this guard? Would they be appointed under this Guardianship Act or under a different part of statute?
Chairman Clement, this is a different part. This would be different guardians ad litem. The guardians ad litem OPA has on staff are specifically for child in need of aid cases. This is would be regarding guardians ad litem representing adults in guardianship cases if the need arose. I strongly suspect that it would not necessarily, it's not anticipated to arise as a need if the individual has an attorney to represent them. What sometimes happens in cases now is that an attorney can be allowed to convert their appointment to that of a guardian ad litem. And this statute would, this would eliminate that.
Does that mean there's a part in this bill that specifically talks about guardian ad litems in the non child in need of aid context, and where is that in the bill?
Chairman Clayman, if you can give me just a minute, sure. I can look for it real quick. Is in on page 131, section 1329.470. It would be the new law, section 1329.470, line 30.
So that one section, just 131 to 132, is the one place in which there's specific provisions. If the court's going to ask to appoint a guardian ad litem to somebody who's already got a guardian, is already subject to a guardianship.
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, thank you.
And just one other point with this law is that powers of attorney are not automatically voided under UCOPA. They're viewed to work in conjunction with whatever protective order the court deems necessary. So if a court wishes to void a power of attorney, perhaps it's because the agent is breaching their fiduciary duties to the individual, it certainly can, but a court must affirmatively take action to do so. So this is just yet another change that highlights the emphasis the drafters of UCOPA placed on ensuring that guardianships are truly options of last resort. So just in conclusion, I think adopting SB 190 will ensure that Alaskans will continue to enjoy promoted dignity, autonomy, and safety. Alaska will strengthen legal safeguards and court oversight by enacting this. So again, I thank you for the opportunity to testify and happy to answer any additional questions you may have.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This may not be a question for you, as I'm unsure of how familiar you are with Alaska, so I might ask this of the sponsor and Ms. Hawk. But I see here on page 40, there is kind of draft language around attorneys of power. In it, it says they must substantially follow this form, and in it, there is reference to a notary. Interestingly enough, I was just at the Anchorage LIO trying to get a document notarized along with a colleague of ours for his recent deployment, and we were told the LIO no longer offers notary services. And I'm very curious about some of your thoughts or some of your I'm 141. Oh, yeah, I apologize. 141.
I was on 40, not 141.
It's on 142. It says acknowledgement before me, the undersigned, a notary public. Just your thoughts about how this might be inaccessible or accessible for folks in rural communities, places where there may not be a notary available, and what the definition substantially or substantively follow this type of form might entail. I do know that although the Uniform Code gives us a lot of guidance on what the language might look like, we do have the ability to Alaska size it or to make it fit for Alaska's unique geographic dynamic.
Through the chair, Aurora Hawk, staff to Senator Keel, this is actually a section that the courts have asked us to ask to remove from the bill because they create their forms themselves. And so Mr. Klein may be able to speak to whether the forms currently require a notary and how that works.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Jesse Keel again for the record, I will note that while it makes the most sense for the court to write the court forms, I think that when we look at this particular section, where we provide an example of a power of attorney for a parent to let someone else make certain decisions, not all decisions, about their child. It's worthwhile for that to be verified in some way, something akin to a notary. It's important that there be some precautions in place. I know that the difficulty of finding a notary hits different Alaskans differently. That's a problem we've struggled with for a long time. If memory serves, a few years ago, the state did provide laws requested by a previous lieutenant governor that allowed for some electronic notary services, some remotely accessible notary services. The chairman is smiling. Perhaps he worked more on that bill than I did.
I'm smiling, Senator Keeler, is it was my bill.
And with that, I'll finish.
Unless my memory is not working right, which can happen. But I know I worked extensively on an electronic notary bill, and I believe it was my bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just note that I voted yes.
Well, and I appreciate that vote. Mr. Klein, we know you didn't sponsor the bill, but you probably have more insight on notaries and the availability of notaries than anyone else here today.
The chair, this is Noah Klein, Associate Counsel of the Alaska Court System. I actually am far from an expert on notaries, unfortunately, but I do know that we have notary services at all of our courthouses. I also know that this form is in current law, the one that you're referring to, Senator Tobin. So this form is actually in AS 1326066 currently, and the court system generally does prefer to draft our own forms, and the way that section is currently written, we have the option of using our own form, but the requirements of the forms, the court system doesn't have a specific position on whether or not a notary should be required.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It would be helpful to understand, as I personally have just struggled trying to find a notary in downtown Anchorage. The local bank wasn't available to notarize the documents I needed. The Anchorage Legislative Information Office wasn't able to notarize the documents I needed to. And I can't imagine someone who didn't have their own individual transportation and was able to drive around downtown Anchorage might experience barriers or struggle if those services are getting more challenging to locate as time goes on.
Senator Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on Senator Tobin, I also recently was in Anchorage looking for a notary and did go to three different places and was unable to get my document notarized, which was fascinating to me because I've never gone through that experience before, but it seems to be kind of a current trend. So thank you for bringing that up, Senator Tobin.
And I'll just make the observation. I see Ms. Hawk is coming forward. She probably has further thoughts on the notary topic. The goal of the electronic notary was and I think is to make notaries more accessible, but it doesn't come without plenty of challenges. And in just work periodically on specifically helping clients deal with estate planning matters. I am not an estate planning lawyer, but sometimes I have clients that want me to assist them in that process. And it become that in the old days, you felt like you sort of go down to the bank, show that you're working at that or you're an account holder at the bank, and then somebody takes you quickly over and you notarize something and go on your merry way. And it has gone from that dynamic to if you want to get notarized at the bank, you better call in advance and schedule an appointment because they have so many people coming for to get documents notarized that you actually need to be prepared to either wait a long time or have an appointment and you better show up on time because you might lose your appointment and come back a week later. Places like UPS stores have notaries available for a fee, and usually you can go there without an appointment. But the challenge of getting a notary, even with the electronic notaries, is a real challenge today. And I think one of the ways some documents address that is instead of requiring a notary, there'll be an alternative to allow two witnesses so that instead of having the person signing and the notary who's your single witness, instead you get two people that are witnesses, and so you have more witnesses, so you have more means to check the verification. And so one way to deal with that challenge of can't find a notary or it's taking me all day and I only had one day to do it and now the day's gone and I didn't get the notary might be provisions that would allow some alternative to a notary to to verify the signature, and which is actually not unlike what we sometimes do in election-related things, and allow somebody to verify who they really are and don't always have notaries, sometimes have to. I know that's a somewhat wandering observation, but those are things that might be worth looking at.
Mr. Chair, I would also note that I once tried to go to the lieutenant governor's office who oversees the notary program to get a notary, and it did not work.
Duly noted. All right. Are there any other questions? I would note that this is 162 pages. The plan that as chair of the committee I have is this won't be our last hearing. Our plan is to have Senator Keel's office back two or three more times and go through in more detail separate sections of the bill. I don't want to try to get us all to consume 160 pages of what some might describe as somewhat dry and not necessarily the most exciting thing we ever see in the legislature. So we're going to try to do this over two or three hearings so we can have a pretty good understanding of the depth of the bill. All right. Senator Keel, Ms. Hawk, thank you very much. Try to find where I am. We're going to go ahead and set the bill aside unless, Senator Keel, you'd like to make any last remarks. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for taking the committee's time today and a couple of the subsequent hearings. I encourage members of the committee, if there are specific sections or issues that pique your interest, we were happy to spend time on those specifically. Just let us know.
Seeing nothing else, thank you again for the presentation. We're going to put this aside for further review, and we're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting will be on Monday, February 9th at 1:30 p.m. We'll be having our first hearing on House Bill 101, Crimes Against Minors, Age of Consent to 18, sponsored by Representative Gray. With that, we're going to stand adjourned. The time is now 2:27 p.m.